Okay, we're back. So I was talking a bit about the Baptists. The Baptists are kind of an unusual group because it's hard to tie down who actually began this group. But it was a back to the Bible, Christian originalist, primitivist movement in the 1600s, which remained fairly small, both in England and in the U.S., until actually the 19th century, in the Second Great Awakening, when the Baptist movement spread like wildfire across America. When the Baptists came to the New World, the biggest number actually were General Baptists, Roger Smith, who came to Rhode Island, was a Baptist, a General Baptist. But the form of baptism that ended up, a Baptist that ended up in Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, was mainly particular Baptists, Calvinistic Baptists. And when there was the explosion of the Baptist movement in America, so that it's now the largest Protestant denomination in America, that was the particular Baptist, which is not that surprising, because in a slave-holding state, to have this idea of total depravity, that only certain people are born even to be able to be saved, you can see how that could support the theology, the tulip, if you will, could support the theology. And the Southern Baptist Church has some answering to do historically. Now, let's talk about Jacob Arminius. Jacob Arminius was Dutch. I'm actually going back just like 10 years or so. Jacob Arminius died about the time the Baptists were getting started in England. Anyway, Jacob Arminius was a disciple of Theodore Beza, and Beza was the successor to John Calvin, and Beza was the one who sort of put into a concrete, if you will, the whole tulip doctrine, and he was more Calvinistic than Calvin. Now, what was happening is, already within 30 or 40 years of the Reformation of Lutheranism and Calvinism and Zwingliitism, by 1550, 1670, the Protestants were tending to get into being very intellectual. It wasn't a very emotional religion. It was very much intellectual, and they sort of had a reformed sort of scholasticism, and they began to argue and sort of compete to be more Calvinistic than Calvin. So you have amongst the what became the Dutch Reformed Church and the Calvinists in Geneva, arguments over supralapsarianism and infralapsarianism. The supralapsarianists taught that God predestined some to heaven and some to hell before he even created the world or any human beings at all. That before humans were even created, God had already decreed those would be lost and those would be saved. Then you had the infralapsarianism, kind of like that God predestined the reprobate to hell after he created the universe and human beings. So they're slightly less mean Calvinists, if you will. So they taught that first God created the world, then he allowed Adam and Eve to fall into sin, and then he predestined from there some to heaven and some to hell. But the Dutch Reformed Church in general were supra-lapsarianists. They were hyper-Calvinists. And Arminius, the young, brilliant theologian, was training under Beza in Geneva, and he was asked to produce a treatise, if you will, on supra-lapsarianism. And in the process, he lost his supra-lapsarian faith, and he discovered essentially that we're not saved by faith alone. We're discovered that God works with us. He became a synergist, like Thomas Aquinas and like the early church, and like the Anabaptist, he became synergist. He taught a concept of prevenient grace, that God in his God is sovereign, but in his sovereignty, he gives us the ability to decide whether we're going to obey him or to not obey him. He was accused of Catholic sympathy, which was not true. He was accused of teaching work salvation, which was definitely not true. He was accused of being Pelagian, which was certainly not true, but he was kind of a semi-Pelagian, if you will. And by the way, if anyone accuses you of being Arminian, feel free to be offended that somebody would want to label you like that if you want. But the bottom line is, those of us in the Stone Campbell movement, we are Arminian in our theology. In other words, we believe that God works with us. He doesn't force us. He doesn't predetermine if we'll be saved. Okay? And so that's Arminius and Arminianism. Now, I'm working towards describing the formation of evangelicalism. Next, I have to talk about John and Charles Wesley. John Wesley, this is now 18th century. He started the most important religious movement in the 18th century there in England. He started a holiness movement. He strongly stressed adult conversion, which was not what Lutheran was doing. He stressed sort of like a second conversion. In other words, we were baptized as babies, and then that causes us to be forgiven of original sin. So we got the first baptism, and then you have the second conversion event, which would be adults, in which adults would move towards sort of a kind of sanctification, a higher level of sanctification. In fact, ultimately, he became accused of perfectionism. If anyone could be accused of being Pelagian, it would probably be John Wesley. He was accused of believing that we could become, in a sense, sinless. And by the way, I believe that if you understand John Wesley correctly, he may not be quite as far out there as you think. Because I believe if we understand the distinction between willful sin and non-willful sin, I believe that as Christians, we can move in the direction so that willful sin is something that is nearly free in we're nearly free of in our lives. But anyway, he taught like a rigorous sort of Christianity, highly devoted to a certain amount of prayer, certain amount of Bible study. They were very, very involved in helping the poor. In England and at this time, the poor were kind of left on their own because of Calvinism. And he was persecuted. He was very much persecuted there in England because of this. And he was accused of having enthusiasms. It was under John Wesley, the idea that you have this conversion experience. Ultimately, the idea that kind of in a way led to this pray Jesus into your heart experiential conversion that is familiar to us in evangelicalism. Wesley strongly influenced John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, and William Wilberforce, who was able to eliminate slavery in England. There's a lot of things I like about Wesley. The idea that he was Arminian, that he believed in free will. It's been estimated that he traveled 250,000 miles in his career, and he preached 40,000 sermons. He preached a famous sermon titled Free Grace. Interestingly, though, his closest right-hand man, George Whitefield, was strongly Calvinist, and Whitefield and Wesley divided over the issue of predestination. Anyway, Methodism came to America. In 1770, there were 20 Methodist churches in America. In 1790, there were 712 Methodist churches in America. And by 1860, at the end of the Second Great Awakening, there were 20,000 Methodist churches in America, and Methodism became the largest Christian group in America at that time. Later on, they were passed by the Baptists. All right, so now I want to just spend a little bit of time. I don't have a lot of time for this because there's so much to cover, but I want to cover the history of evangelicalism in America. So we're going to go next to Jonathan Edwards. Jonathan Edwards, who was a hyper-Calvinist. He was a Puritan. He was congregationalist in his polity. In other words, he believed in complete church autonomy. He, like the Arminian Wesley, believed in this adult conversion experience. In fact, in America, in the 1700s, church attendance was quite low. We think of America as a Christian nation, but if America ever became a Christian nation, it was not during the 18th century. I don't have solid figures from this, but I believe in the 1760s and 70s, church attendance in America was lower than it is today. And it's because the church kind of became angry. And you had to prove that you had had a conversion experience. And Jonathan Edwards famously preached his sermon, A Sinner in the Hands of the Angry God. There's a quick quote from that sermon. He said, "The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider of some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you, is dreadfully provoked. His wrath towards you burns like fire. He looks upon you as of worth nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times more abominable in his eyes, as the most hateful venomous serpent is in ours. You have offended him infinitely more than ever a stubborn rebel did his prince. And yet 'tis nothing but his hand that holds you from falling into the fire every moment. O sinner, consider the fearful danger you are in." So anyway, he stressed this experiential conversion event. You had to prove before the board of the church that you had some sort of adult emotional revival experience. So under Jonathan Edwards and what became known as the First Great Awakening there in Northfield, Massachusetts, the idea of revival, and there was this a revival nowhere near as great as the Second Great Awakening, but there was this very short-lived 5-year revival that happened in England and in the U.S., largely overseen by the great theologian Jonathan Edwards. And so the idea is that there's this second sanctification, this second awakening, which is the one in which you become a Christian upon having this faith event, if you will, this very emotional awakening of your spirit. All right, so anyway, the First Great Awakening, which in my opinion was not really all that great, because within a few years, honestly, most of New England and most of the central colonies had gone back to being pretty much what they'd been before, and a church attendance went back down to what had been before. But then there's the Second Great Awakening, and this was truly a massive religious event. It happened in England and America, but more in America than England. The starting gun of this was what's known as the Cane Ridge Revival of 1801. I'm going to discuss that later when I talk about Barton Stone. But what this is was a massive awakening of religious sentiment in America. It began right around 1800. So in the late 1700s, the Methodist Church was fairly small. The Baptist Church was fairly small. Almost all American churches were Calvinistic in their thinking. But also there was kind of an angry Calvinism, if you will, and church attendance was relatively low. But there was this massive outbreaking of Christian sentiment. It happened on the frontier. In fact, this Cane Ridge Revival happened in Kentucky. And what happened was there were almost no churches on the frontier. And so they had these revivals hundreds, thousands of came to this revival in Kentucky. And you had Methodists, you had Presbyterians, you had Baptists, all denominations sort of showing up. And there were these spontaneous outpourings, people rolling and barking at trees and having charismatic experiences. And at the Cane Ridge Revival, there'd be 3, 4, 5 preachers at once. And it was crazy. And these revivals broke out and it began a religious revolution in America, which truly affected the entire culture of America. And in the Second Great Awakening, Christianity in America became something it had not been before. American Christianity became highly individualistic. This was the time of Scottish common sense philosophy. And so the general tendency within Christianity in America was to become patternistic, biblicist, individual Christians sort of separated, broke the chains from their denominations. They enjoyed the right to interpret the Bible for themselves. This is when the Stone Campbell movement came into being, which is no surprise at all. Common sense philosophy, like I said, came into play. Reason became applied to theology and biblical interpretations. And by the way, Calvinists are not big friends of common sense philosophy because they teach that pre-conversion people are totally depraved. And so during the Second Great Awakening, there was a softening of Calvinism, and Arminian Christianity became quite significant in America under the Stone Campbell movement, which I'll talk about later, and Methodism, which became the largest group. And also, this Second Great Awakening was very optimistic. They taught post-millennialism, that America was going to be the center of this great awakening, which would take over the world, and it would bring in a great Christian age, and then Jesus would come back. All right, a couple of quotes. And then we'll stop for our break here. It was during the Second Great Awakening that this Americanization was carried out to its full. Charles Finney, who I'll talk about after the break, represents this process. American republicanism combined with Baconian empiricism and common Scottish sense philosophy produced a uniquely American Christianity, which became evangelicalism. Which soundly rejected ecclesiastical authority in favor of the personal right of every believer to interpret the Bible in its plain and literal sense for themselves. This is the legacy which American Christianity handed to the world in the Second Great Awakening. That democracy and capitalism are ideals well aligned with Christian theology and practice is a new idea, created in the Second Great Awakening. The former, that democracy was aligned with Christian thinking, came in place in the First Great Awakening with Jonathan Edwards, and the latter, that capitalism was aligned with Christian thinking, is the result of the Second Great Awakening. Christians today in the West take these as givens, but we do well to have a historical perspective on the radical shift in the Christian paradigm that happened during this crucial period in history of Christianity. So next, then, we're going to talk about Charles Finney, Billy Sunday, Billy Graham, Bill Bright, and the history of the creation of evangelicalism in America, which is a fascinating story, but we're going to take a break.